Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Rebecca Freire, number 20010. I'm the Deputy State Public Defender appearing on behalf of Mr. Friend. The court did order supplemental briefing on this multiplicity issue. I think my supplemental opening brief pretty clearly stated my position. I know the state and I disagree that the child abuse statute reflects alternate ways of committing the crime of child abuse. Because the state requested oral argument in this case, I think I would like to reserve my time, my argument time for rebuttal so that I have a clearer understanding of what the state's theory is on the whole merger issue.
That's fine if you choose to do that.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Holman.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman and I represent the people in this matter. I'm tempted to rest on the briefs at this moment and then we can all leave immediately after that, I think. But I won't do that. And I am the one that asked for argument. And I would say there are two reasons. One is I felt like there were points I wanted to make about the issues here. Certainly the questions from the court indicate some concern that many, if not all, of these offenses should merge, and I wanted to obviously make argument that I don't think that's correct. And then also, I'm concerned that I might have missed something that the court wanted to know in those questions that were asked. I want to start with I'm going to follow the court's lead in the initial order for supplemental briefing, which is essentially presuming that the claims aren't waived, addressing the merits of the issues. Now, in this context, the claims were not preserved, and so if they're not waived, we would go to plain error review. Under those circumstances, there must be an error, and it must be plain, that is obvious or clear, and that it must affect substantial rights. An error that is plain or obvious is one that is so clear-cut that a trial judge should be able to avoid it without the benefit of any objection whatsoever. And an error is substantial if it so undermines the fundamental fairness of the trial as to cast doubt on the conviction's reliability. Now, as I mentioned in my brief, in the context of double jeopardy and merger claims where we have multiple acts over multiple days, there are several plain error thresholds that have to be overcome to find plain error that would require any kind of a remedy. The first is that there must be a finding that the evidence plainly did not support separate convictions in this case, that it's so obvious to the trial court that they didn't support separate convictions that the court would have acted on its own. The other is that the legislature's intended unit of prosecution is so clear and obvious, again, that the court would act on its own. Before a plain error can be found, these questions must be answered in the affirmative. Now, before I turn to those questions, I want to point out another one, which is, as this court is well aware, there's a dispute between panels of this court as to whether claims that are not preserved for double jeopardy and merger are waived or whether they are subject to plain error. Now, under those circumstances, I would argue that the trial court could not have acted in a manner that this was a plain error situation, that it was so obvious and clear that the court should have acted that it would reach plain error, because panels of this court disagree as to whether they're waived. So ostensibly the trial court is following the those court panels that say that the claim is waived by acting. And where there are divisions of this court that have held that the claim is waived, it seems impossible that the trial court can be faulted for following suit with those cases and essentially assuming that the defendant has waived any double jeopardy or merger claims. Now, beyond that, assuming that we can get over that hurdle, there are also several reasons why there is no plain error here. One is that, as it's set forth in the original answer brief, there are several distinct elements for each of these crimes, and I'm not going to go through them in detail. I think they're laid out clearly there, so that the crimes on their face elementally are distinct from one another, that the murder count has a knowing causing of death to a child under 12 by one in a position of trust. The child abuse counts either have a knowing or reckless causing of injury or permitting a child to be unreasonably placed in a situation that poses a threat of injury, or where it's under the pattern of conduct element, it's engaging in a particular pattern of conduct that results in either a lack of medical care, mistreatment, or accumulation of injuries. Those operate in different ways here, but they're all independent elements. I would also point out that the original charges actually set different brackets of time. Some encompass the entire time period from the 13th to the 16th. Some are for one day, some are for the 13th through the 15th. I think there's one for the 14th and the 15th. So both elementally and as they're charged, it's not, again, plain or obvious that they would encompass the same acts.
Mr. Holman, let me start by asking you about the actual language of the child abuse statute, 18.6401 in subsection 1A, that it seems to use the word or in several places. And as you know, there are a number of court decisions that say when the word or is used, that suggests that there are different ways of committing the same offense. So, and in your brief, you disagreed with the applicability of that principle to this statute. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. I think when you read the sections, one is there are several ors here. And I would say that they are not alternative. They're not simply alternative ways of committing one crime. I mean, theoretically, I suppose you could have a series of events that encompass all of these in one immediate event, although perhaps a lack of medical care as a pattern of conduct would be unusual for an immediate event. But I think when you look at these, unlike, for example, the controlled substance statutes, that the focus of the unit of prosecution is the harm that's inflicted by the defendant, which is either the it would be causing an injury to a child's life or health, that would be one, or unreasonably placing a child in a situation that poses a threat of injury. Those are different types of crimes here, and then we have the pattern of conduct one, which involves a pattern of conduct as a means of inflicting one of these harms. But when you look at the statute, it's unlike the drug statute, which the Supreme Court has said is focused on one quantum of drugs. The focus of these sections is on inflictions of particular types of harm, albeit to children. The child is not a quantum of evidence. The child is someone who over time is being injured here. And I think, let's assume that somehow they actually could involve, all be one alternative way of doing this. Then we would go to the next point, which is here we have intervening events between the assaults on this child.
Excuse me, before you get to the next point, let me just follow up on my first question and ask you, if you are correct that the statute lays out bases for different offenses, then from a grammatical standpoint, what do we do with the word or? And how do we distinguish this case from a Biodun or some of the other cases that have talked about alternative means of committing an offense?
I think Abiodun, the sort of the linchpin of that case, as I recall, is the language about, I'm getting them mixed up. I think whatever it is about the statutory language there, it's clear that they're talking about one quantum of drugs and the various series of events that may lead to and involve possession of those drugs or distribution of those drugs. I think it's in the sexual assault setting where they say, and maybe that is Abiodun, any sexual contact essentially encompasses all the sexual contact that occurs during the event.
The sexual contact case is Wohlhoff.
Okay, thank you, Wohlhoff. And I think this case doesn't involve any language like that. Again, one is the focus of the person commits child abuse if causes an injury to a child, or child's life or health, or commits it by permitting a child to be unreasonably placed in a situation that poses a threat, or engages in a continued pattern of conduct that results in malnourishment, lack of, et cetera, et cetera. So that the focus of the unit of prosecution is the harm, and I'd rely on the Deskins case, which says that the culpable mental state in this statute relates to the nature of the offender's conduct and not to a particular result. So it's not the death or the serious bodily injury to the child, but it's the infliction of the harm itself, the knowing infliction of the injury of some type, that's sufficient to encompass a completed offense here.
So let me get to the next point that you were going, I think you were going to address about the specific dates or events involved in the charges. And as you indicated before, some of them indicate acts occurring on January 13th, another January 14th or January 15th. So, and some of them are separate and some of them are overlapping. So how do you parse all of those different counts?
Well, I want to start with this premise, which is, the question is not, can I parse all the counts out? The question is it plainly obvious that they do not support separate convictions under the plain error standard? So that would be the question here. But I'm prepared to talk about the individual counts also. They're outlined in the brief, so I don't want to be overly redundant about that. But I think there are events that can be attached to each of the counts here. For example, the child abuse resulting in serious bodily injury on January 13th, 2008. There's an event where the defendant strikes this four-year-old child so hard that she flies through the air and her head, back of her head strikes a door. That happens on the 13th. There, one of the things we look for in these settings is, are there separate volitional acts? Are there intervening events? What's the temporal proximity? The location of the victim, and granted this is taking place in an apartment, but I think the big sort of breaks in this are that there are clearly separate volitional acts here by the defendant, and they're separated in time and by intervening events between the times that he's doing all these things. For the pattern of conduct, I think there are several events here that show that the defendant inflicts an injury where this child is obviously badly hurt. She's either rendered unconscious or she later is vomiting, so that it's clear that she needs some medical attention. If it's not apparent from the nature of the infliction of the injury itself, the symptoms make it obvious. And count six is one where it says it's child abuse, serious bodily injury, pattern of conduct, covering the 13th to the 15th. And again, these are charging ranges. That's not saying we're charging an event over that time. That's notice that it occurred during this period. And there's on the evening of the 13th, the defendant struck the victim in the head and she fell to the ground and became unresponsive. And although she is not sleeping well after he somehow revives her, he basically does nothing but go to sleep and then goes to work the next day and comes home at 5 o'clock. So he's inflicted this. He's engaging in this lack of medical care where it's apparent that she needs it, although I would argue that it's not required that he know that she needs serious medical care, but only that he knows that he's not getting it for her after she's been injured like this. The child abuse, count five, serious bodily injury between January 14th and 15th, and covers an event on the night of the 14th, where the defendant struck the victim so hard that she hit the bed face forward and then sprung backwards and hit her head on the carpeted floor, which was thinly carpeted concrete. And again, her injuries were severe. For the child abuse resulting in death counts, there are again more events where the defendant and the victim's mother are striking the child in the back of the head. They describe it as popping her in the head or flicking her in the head, but hitting her hard in the head, and also not providing, for both those counts, not providing any medical care whatsoever. I think the defendant's solution is to put her in the bathtub, maybe submerge her head in the bathtub, but it's definitely not getting her actual medical care of any kind, whether himself or through someone else, to treat the child. So there are events on both those days that would support that. And then I think we have the overall acts of the defendant where ultimately we get to the murder where he must know, and the jury found this, that he knowingly caused the death, that we get down to the final event where he strikes her in the head on the 15th. And then seeing that she's unconscious, becomes unconscious or unresponsive, she's urinated on herself, she's vomited, does nothing. And so he's obviously knowingly inflicted these killing acts.
Mr. Holman, I just want to clarify a little bit. Under the Blockberger test, we don't look at the evidence, though. We look at just the strict elements. So you're going a lot into the evidentiary basis.
That's correct.
And not so much the elements of the two statutes. So we have two separate statutes for murder and then child abuse resulting in murder. What about looking at the evidence, though, under the multiplicity test for just the child abuse statute?
Can you be more specific? I'm sorry.
Well, have you found any authority that it's appropriate to go beyond the information and look at the evidence? Or is it based on that? Because the information itself does not distinguish factually any of these events.
Well, I think the information is the purpose of the information is to give notice to the defendant of what the charges are and when they occur. I think that under the plain error standard, I see I'm out of time.
Go ahead and finish your answer.
I was hoping to stop, but
the red light is feverishly blinking, but nevertheless, we'd like you to finish your response.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. I think that no matter what, when it's the notice and the charges is one thing, but whether the evidence supports individual separate counts is a separate question. And here, I think that's the reason the evidence here would support the separate convictions. Is just as if he abused her in March and abused her in July, those are sufficiently separate by intervening events that they would constitute separate offenses. I know I'm out of time, and I would thank the court for its time and for setting this special argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Holman.
I'm going to start with your question, Judge Dunn, about any authority for looking into the facts of the case. And I think really, if you kind of start with Woolhoff and Abiodun, because Woolhoff provides the framework for looking at these multiplicity issues and describes the three ways. The statutory elements of the Blockberger test, clearly you don't look at the facts, and that was stated by the Supreme Court in the Leskey case, because that was an argument that the defense tried to make, is we should develop an evidentiary test, and the Supreme Court said, no, you don't look at the facts. But what the state doesn't mention about all this is 18-1408, and 18-1408 plays into this whole analysis about what you do with these various charges. I think the authority for looking into the facts are the other two methods that Woolhoff describes, the alternate ways of committing a crime. You've got to look at what is charged in the case, and you've got to look at the supporting evidence. That's why in the Supreme Court and Woolhoff talks about how, you know, there was not that temporal proximity between the different acts of sexual contact that the jury convicted him of, so you couldn't say they were distinct offenses. They were alternate ways of committing sexual assault. And without that temporal aspect of it, we've got to merge all these sexual assaults, and then we've got to merge all these sexual assault position of trusts together, because there's no temporal proximity like in the Quintano case. I really think that you have to look at the statute first, and all of those ors that Judge Taubman asked about, the statute's plain language indicates from our case law, Abiodun, from Woolhoff, we've got the Holmes case, the Wright case, the Vidiua case. All of those cases say that when a statute describes conduct using that disjunctive or, that the legislative intent is to describe different ways of committing the same crime. And if you look at Section 1A of the child abuse statute, that is exactly what it's doing, is describing alternate ways of committing the crime of child abuse.
Ms. Freire, yes. If you're correct in that regard, why do you think the General Assembly has child abuse serious bodily injury and then child abuse serious bodily injury pattern of conduct?
Because I think that it gives the prosecutor more charging options. Theoretically, under 1A, an actor, a defendant, could hit a kid repeatedly or do something repeatedly that maybe didn't cause a serious bodily injury, just caused an injury, was a misdemeanor. But collectively, at some point, that repeated abuse created serious bodily injury or even resulted in death. And a prosecutor then would have the option of taking that continuum of abuse that individually might be misdemeanor conduct and to charge it as a felony under 1A because it is a pattern of conduct that ultimately results in a serious bodily injury. The statute itself says if you distinguishes between these offenses in terms of what the sentence is, by the mens rea, whether it's knowingly or recklessly versus negligently, and by the degree of harm, whether it's serious bodily injury or death, or whether there is no injury. Which then is what is described in 18108(5)(c). Okay, an offense is included if it only is different by the mens rea or by the degree of injury suffered. If you look at what is charged in this case by the prosecutor, all of the charges except for the first one, except for count one, they're all charged under 1A. Those are all different ways that they allege Mr. Friend inflicted child abuse. I think what's really telling about this case and what was a problem for the prosecution was that there was not an identifiable injury that caused the death. And if you look at the court file, page 3, at the bottom of the probable cause affidavit, the detective says the doctors, two different doctors are giving different causes of death, but they both agree it was non-accidental. Okay? Even in the very beginning, there was an issue about what caused this child's death. And so the prosecution, in charging this, had to include all of the acts of abuse that were described by my client and the co-defendant in their interviews in order to sustain a first-degree murder conviction. And if this had been a case where that bedroom injury, and I know that the Attorney General described the bedroom injury as the final event that caused the murder, but that's not what was charged. First degree murder was that range of January 13th through the 16th. The prosecutor always had an accumulation of injuries theory of death. The vast majority of child abuse death cases I've seen, there is a final injury. And had this child gone to the emergency room with an acute subdural hematoma that was causing massive swelling that required immediate surgery to relieve that swelling, you could have had the felony or the murder charged on the 15th or the 14th. It's a little bit unclear as to what day it was. But that's not what happened. Her CT scan didn't show that last final act was the cause of her death, and that was part of the problem. And so what the prosecutor did in this case, I agree that the conduct on the 13th, the slam against the door, is there are facts to support that is a separate act. It was charged as a separate act. The jury convicted him of that act. The problem is that there is also a pattern of abuse count that includes that act. And there is a first-degree murder count that includes that act. And there's a child abuse causing death count that includes that act, okay? And so under 18.1408 and the cases that are in the briefs, those counts merge. And it's my position too, you know, I don't know that you need to go to a statutory elements type of analysis for count one. I think that you can because clearly they're two different statutes, but I think that's the only kind of framework in which a pure statutory elements test really will work in this case. I think that you can, if you look at subsection 7C of the child abuse statute, it includes all the elements of the first degree murder statute. Okay, so 7C, at least in my view, is another way of charging child abuse resulting in death.
But counsel, they didn't actually charge that section for the first degree murder.
They didn't.
It's nowhere in the information.
That's correct. They went directly to the first degree murder statute, and they charged that. But if you look under the statutory elements test, if the prosecutor proves every element of the greater offense, okay, knowingly causing the death of a child under the age of 12 by someone who is in a position of trust, just proving that first element, knowingly causing the death of the child, proves all of the lesser offenses here. Because that count is based on a pattern of conduct, an accumulation of injuries theory. It includes all the conduct from January 13th through the 16th. And that's what I think kind of makes this case unique and distinguishable from some of the other cases, specifically from most child abuse resulting in death cases, where you have an event that you can point to that caused the child's death. And you just didn't have that here. And the prosecutor argued in closing, the prosecutor argued even before in the pretrial motions when they were doing in limine motions before the trial. Our theory is that this man repeatedly abused this child, and it's this accumulation of injuries that caused her death. So if you don't have any other questions.
I have a question.
Okay.
let's hypothetically say we agree and we read the child abuse statute as disjunctive. There's no authority that says that. We ourselves require a supplemental briefing on it. So how could that be plain error?
Well, because I think that Abby Oden and Woolhoff were out there at the time of trial. They'd been out there for a long time. You had the Holmes case, you had the Vidiua case, you had the Wright case, where the Supreme Court had said statutes that are written in the disjunctive evidence a legislative intent to describe alternate ways of committing an offense. So I think that is plain error. I mean, it's clear if you look at the information, the court looked at the information and read the statute and saw all the ors, that puts everybody on notice that this is what we're dealing with. And I think the parties somewhat realized that in sentencing, and that's why there was some argument at sentencing about whether these counts should be concurrent or consecutive. So it was something that they were thinking about. They just weren't on the exact issue that I raised in my opening brief. But I do think that some of, I agree with the Attorney General that this whole merger issue is just kind of, there have been some inconsistent opinions coming out of the Court of Appeals on how you approach these cases and how you analyze them. But I can't remember the name of it, and I didn't submit it as supplemental authority, but I do believe that one of them talks about how a violation of a defendant's double jeopardy rights is plainly erroneous. So I do think that there was a lot of case law out there talking about alternate ways of committing an offense. Not a lot. There was the Abby Oden case, and there was Woolhoff. But so clearly that the parties were on notice.
Ms. Freire, if we agree with you that the statute does envision or does describe alternative ways of committing an offense, could Mr. Friend stand convicted of the two separate counts of child abuse causing serious bodily injury?
I don't think so. I think all of those merge into the child abuse death count, or I think they all merge into the first degree murder conviction, because,
well, let's put that aside, that separate, okay, that issue aside for
all right,
but with regard to the five child abuse counts, do you think Mr. Friend could stand convicted of the two child abuse serious bodily injury counts, knowing on the one hand that there's also a serious bodily injury pattern count, and knowing on the other hand that the two individual serious bodily injury counts deal with different dates that don't overlap?
Well, I think, as I put in my supplemental opening brief, okay, before I got to the final issue, I do think that there is evidence to support the separate conviction for the January 13th count. That's slamming against the door, resulting in serious bodily injury. I'm assuming the conduct underlying the 14th and the 15th is the head popping and then the final bed act, okay? But there's also been a pattern count, okay, which is, I think we're talking about 4, 5, and 6. And that pattern count includes the conduct from the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th. So I think that, I don't know if maximizing the verdict would be convicting of the pattern count and merging the other two in, or convicting of the two for the separate days and vacating the pattern count, but I don't think all three can remain there. And I'm not, you know, I still think they all merge into the first degree murder, but yes, I do think that, at least hypothetically, without considering that whole merger thing,
right.
Yes, it could be counts 4 and 5, but not 6, or count 6 and not 4 and 5. And I think I put that in my opening brief.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, then I would ask you to merge them all into the first degree murder count. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Freire. Thank you, Mr. Holman. We really appreciate your arguments this afternoon on these merger and double jeopardy issues. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.